experiences that have led you to where you are today? I mean, you mentioned that you had many experiences that helped you in sort of thinking about new innovative programs. And you're a place where you'd probably see many of the innovative programs in the area.
Yeah.
So this interview is basically about people who would see and know about social entrepreneurship, and that's not something that I like to use that term to start out with, because people try to figure out, well, what exactly is it. I'm not quite interested in that, in defining it. So I'm just finding out what you do, and
all
what experiences have led you to see certain things as positive directions for innovation,
etc.
All
right. I guess I'd given some thought to the email when you said, well, gee, everything sounds good. I'd taken it a couple of steps forward, I think, when I had mentioned my work at City Hall and the gang intervention at Syracuse 2020. You know, really, over the years, Frank, I've done a considerable, I'd say, amount of work with young people in this community. And one of the things that I guess focused particularly on is sort of what do they do when they're not in school? And what they do when they're not in school, how can they learn things and be more productive so that they can be more successful in school for years? And actually, this goes back. It's interesting. I hadn't thought about it till right now when I'm looking at you. There was a Father Ryan, I think, at Lemoyne years ago. And probably in the year, I want to say 2000, 2001, he gave I wonder if I even still have it, but he gave a background that he did sort of on this is the young person of today and this is the young person 15, 20 years ago and all the different challenges that young people have. And at the time I was at the Private Industry Council and we were being challenged to have jobs programs that would respond to sort of that non-traditional youth who likely was involved with a gang. Specifically, the kids were wearing different gang colors at the time, but we wouldn't allow them to come in for a job interview if they had their hood on, their red hood or their blue hood or their white hood or whatever it was. And they abide by that, interestingly enough. The notion of a job and some wage and a safe you know, way to earn money sort of appealed to some of them. In any event, this committee of Syracuse 2020 that was meeting with me at the Private Industry Council started talking about how can we help young people be more successful. How can we whether it's gang involvement, whether it's just after school mischief, whether it was the traditional things that years ago, maybe I know some of my counterparts did, you know, steal cars, things like that. How can we, you know, provide other possibilities for young people? Well, in any event, here's where the social entrepreneurship comes in. I think what they said is, you know, let's think of a way that Syracuse 2020 and lots of different organizations, and it came out to be about 18 or 20 of them actually, joined together to create a new environment for young people in a school situation which linked the school to the community service agencies and to that young person and their families. And so what I'm going to get to the point in a minute here in terms of social entrepreneurism. So at the time, I shifted to Syracuse 2020, and ironically enough, the funder became United Way of Central New York, where I sit now.
So you went from City Hall to 2020?
No, I went from the Private Industry Council, where I worked for the mayor and the county executive. In 2000, went to work for Syracuse 2020. And actually, Charlie Byrne was one of the great promoters of this, saying, let's develop a youth development model. Let's create a youth development model, which really is going to get at the heart of some of these challenges we saw when we were trying to work with the gang kids. And the challenges, we said, were really around three areas. One, keeping kids in school. Two, keeping them out of jail. And three, providing them with enough of a work experience opportunity, whether it's, you know, job orientation, whether it's job shadowing, any of those kinds of techniques that they use, that they could reasonably be successful if they got a job. And basically we said, you know, if we try to do those three things, the rest of their lives are likely to fall into place. Not necessarily absolutely, but there's a lot of good likelihood that they will be successful. Staying in school, staying out of jail, getting a job. Okay? Pretty simple. So in any event, we went into this notion of let's work with the idea of working with and through the schools and the current community organizations. And we created a model that started at Shea Middle School, which was the community school model. We learned a lot from Rochester about this model. I actually went to Rochester and studied it. Where it took the young people and started to work with them after school, on the weekends, with their families, and brought together the different resources so that they could be delivered primarily at the school. And a lot of schools have done this a lot more successfully than Syracuse has. Today, they have what they call the West Side Service Strategy, where they've taken six schools. They've built on this model that started at Shea Middle School, which is now Bellevue Middle. And they've created six schools, and now they have this service strategy where they have social workers that are in each of these schools with community school coordinators working to try to In many ways, answer those three issues. You know, how do we retain the kids in school so they don't drop out, particularly at that middle school age as they go from sixth, seventh, to eighth grade? We have seen and I think it's still continuing in Syracuse. We have seen that that's where young people really begin to fail. So that once they get to high school, you know, if they make it through their sophomore year, they're probably going to be okay. But for example, I remember one kid in particular. We were studying quite closely. He was a sixth grader. He had a 20% attendance. He was there one day out of five as a sixth grader. And the kid, the reason why he came, we think, was because he was in the gospel choir that he had available during the school, that one day after school. He seemed, and this was sort of the concept, what's working to keep the kids in school and making them successful? Is it something the school is providing or something that the community service or other agency in the neighborhood is providing? And we try to link those all together. And so that was one of the things we found. Now, sixth grade, I can't imagine missing about 4 days a week as a sixth grader. But that was the case. And we said, this kid is never going to, he is never going to be successful if he if he's not there 4 days out of the week. So those are the kind of challenges we tried to work with this community school concept. So it's evolved now from those meetings. And actually, Father Ryan was one of the ones that sort of was helping us cook all this up.
Is this Ed Ryan or Vinny Ryan? I'm thinking it's Ed.
The one that passed.
Yes.
The one that passed away. The old, he was very...
Well, they both older.
He was very old. He had been around. He was like a legend at Lemoyne. I think it was Ed. I want to say Ed.
Doesn't matter.
And Charlie Byrne brought him to the meeting. So, and again, Charlie was a part of all this. So we started this community concept at Shea Middle School. It's now grown to six schools. And actually, United Way is back in at this point. Now I'm here, and I'm sort of tracking this, trying not to make it a favorite project because we have to be neutral. One of the things that we have funded at $75,000 last year and are considering another request for around $50,000 through one of our special funds, it's called a community initiative fund. And this is where we take gaps in service, cutting edge types of things and try to fund them. Well, what we're trying to say in our funding piece, Frank, is that we're trying to see if we can have them develop a database. And this database would then allow, you'll hear where I'm going in a minute here because it's pretty scary, would allow these six schools to share information about the students, okay, now elementary, middle school, share information not only about the students but about their families. So we bring in the different community-based organizations. And so what happens then is if there's a Lazarski family and I'm acting out as a sixth grader, and I don't talk about it, and I don't say anything, the school will theoretically and ideally should know that, let's say, my brother, older brother, has just been sent to jail, and maybe sent to jail for life, for committing some sort of a terrible crime, murder. And so what kind of services then do I need as a sixth grader mm-hmm. in order to cope with this?
Mm-hmm.
Right now, that kind of information is not well developed and well shared mm-hmm. at the school level. Mm-hmm. Conversely, if there's an after-school program at Huntington Family Center mm-hmm. that can help me get through this, mm-hmm. then Huntington Family Center ought to be communicating with that school about, we can help Frank mm-hmm. get through the mm-hmm. fact that his older brother is now in prison for life.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, those kinds of things are, I mean, unless, let's say, the way it works now, anecdotally, is somebody in that, you know, school would say, geez, you know, I think I've heard of this program over here that might be able to help Frank, but, mm-hmm. you know, let's make a call. This way, it's more proactive, mm-hmm. it's more preventative mm-hmm. in nature. Mm-hmm. Theoretically, that's the way all this mm-hmm. is going to work.
Mm-hmm.
Now, one of the reasons why we're talking about a database is because you need somewhere to store all mm-hmm. this information about the family and about the kids. And, of course, one of the things that they're looking at is, you know, can it be done mm-hmm. just in terms of the automation, but also can it be done legally? With all the different laws that are around in terms of sharing family information mm-hmm. and all of that. So that's where we are with all of this, mm-hmm. and it really grew out of a very, you know, small idea about, geez, we got all these services here in this community for young people. There's lots of things happening, but we still have this incredible gang problem, and we still have this incredible youth mm-hmm. issue that's going on. And I think even today we would say that you know, there's lots and lots of work to be done here mm-hmm. with this, but that's a start. And what they're trying to do is replicate this model in the other. This is just for the kind of the South Side schools, although they're more strike that near West Side schools. But they want to try to replicate this model around the city with the other schools. If it mm-hmm. works mm-hmm. on the West Side, the West Side service strategy, they're hoping to take it to the different parts of the city.
I believe, is this the same one that I've seen in the new Mahoney administration's, maybe they're not public yet, but sort of plans mm-hmm. for human services. They mm-hmm. really sort of mm-hmm. suggested this is something
sure.
that they'd like to expand.
Yeah, yeah. And actually, the reason why it's in the Mahoney administration with the county is because the county was a significant player when we started to put this together. For example, and I remember the number. It's funny. I remember numbers. We had 28 kids at Shea on probation.
Mm-hmm.
So we had the probation officers, instead of trying to hunt the kids down and find them, the probation officers mm-hmm. were coming to Shea mm-hmm. and helping the kids and finding out how they were being mm-hmm. successful or not mm-hmm. in the middle school and what they could do to help as well.
Mm-hmm.
So we had the probation involved with that. We had Department of Social Services involved as well, both with the kids and with their families. So the county became a pretty significant player mm-hmm. in that, and I think continues to be and really needs to be at the table, as does the city, through especially the police department,
mm-hmm.
And some of the other other mm-hmm. public organizations.
Housing Authority.
Housing Authority was doing, I believe. Well, let me strike that. I'm not sure the Housing Authority, but the Syracuse Community Health Center actually mm-hmm. started a dental clinic mm-hmm. at Shea Middle School, so that they could provide free dental care for the kids
mm-hmm.
because, you know, obviously coming to school and having problems,
mm-hmm.
not comfortable,
mm-hmm.
you know, in pain, that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the dental clinic may have been extended to full health care, and I'm not sure if that's the case right now. But that's another mm-hmm. service. So you can see we started to say, you know, the school is the place where all the kids are.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's a given.
Mm-hmm.
So let's try to bring the services to the school and create this model using, and the school was the convenient location. And turns out that I think it's going to continue to be the convenient location.
Mm-hmm.
Whether the cooperation and coordination and collaboration, and I use all three
mm-hmm.
For good reason, I think, will exist among the school folks
mm-hmm.
and the community service organizations and the public groups like the county,
mm-hmm.
it's going to be a real interesting challenge.
Mm-hmm. But you said this has also worked in other places.
Yeah, we found that one of the nice models we looked at was Rochester, and Rochester mm-hmm. actually had done some school work, actually some renovation work. We looked at two schools. We looked at an older school and a newer school, and they had assimilated the community school people almost into their staff. much more readily than we have here, mm-hmm. and much more accepting of the community school people. There's a, and I'm sure you've seen this with social work, there's an interesting, let's call it a healthy competition, mm-hmm. among mm-hmm. the school people and the social work people. Mm-hmm. We found that they had assimilated more in Rochester than they did here. And I think they've been going on their programs since the early 90s, early mm-hmm. to mid-90s. Mm-hmm. And I believe that the Monroe County had been a significant funder there, too. Mm-hmm. So, again, the presence of that kind of public money in a school mm-hmm. setting mm-hmm. was a pretty mm-hmm. dramatic thing mm-hmm. that we had not seen here yet. Mm-hmm. Although I believe there is some attempt at county money here. Mm-hmm. I want to be careful about that now because I'm not sure of the specifics. Mm-hmm.
Now, did it originate there, or were they in turn sort of modeling theirs off other innovations?
I'm not sure. You know, Rochester's known to be pretty innovative. Uh-huh. But I would bet community school, there's probably was another community school mm-hmm. somewhere around the country mm-hmm. That was pretty successful.
Because mm-hmm. that's sort of a theme in this field. You know, it's just people don't be innovative in a vacuum.
Yeah.
They're inspired
yeah.
by things around.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I know that helped us. I know that the Annie Casey Foundation mm-hmm. we were watching and listening to what they were talking about. And I also know that I believe it was the Harvard After School Program mm-hmm. was something that we were following as mm-hmm. well. I'm a little rusty on some of those details, mm-hmm. but I think those were some of the models that mm-hmm. we were looking at.
And any Casey Foundation was offering funds for it, or they had, and
no,
they were sort of publicizing?
They had pieces of information, particularly data that we were using. Uh-huh, uh-huh. But we were also trying to position ourselves to someday ask them for a grant. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I don't believe that they've done that yet. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Again, I transitioned out of there mm-hmm. in 03. But I don't believe that's one of the funds that they've asked. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I don't think they've asked them for money. Hmm.
What was one of the toughest challenges with doing this, with setting up this near west side model?
Well, when we started at one middle school, and I think one of the toughest challenges was trying to convince the school. Although we had a great principal and an assistant principal, and we had some of the faculty that were very accepting of it, we had other faculty that we found, just thought, this is another program, and this has been tried before, and what do we want to do this for? And, you know, these kids, you know, they're, you know, you can't work with them. And I guess sort of the jadedness of some of the school personnel, some of the, you know, kind of that we've tried this before mentality, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. which it hadn't, to our knowledge, been tried the way we were setting it up. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And also that what I guess bothered us more than anything else was sort of the lack of respect for some of the children and their families. Mm-hmm. I think that was unfortunate that someone's in a teaching position and they have that lack of respect, but they've been beaten down so many times mm-hmm. by the young people or their families mm-hmm. that they really were very discouraged. They were very mm-hmm. frustrated about mm-hmm. their teaching assignments. So one of the enemies that we had met was us, you know, the adults that yeah, were working yeah, on this, yeah. and that was a little difficult. The other thing was, I think, the whole notion of collaboration, and mm-hmm. everybody uses the word interchangeably, you know, mm-hmm. 100 different ways and 100, not sure accurately, but I think when we're trying to create change like this, especially this kind of change, you need organizations to come to the table with resources. Mm-hmm. Not so much what we're going to get out of it or how mm-hmm. we're going to benefit out of it, but how our resources can help make this change be successful. Mm-hmm. And creating that mindset and having people think that way was very difficult and continues mm-hmm. to be mm-hmm. pretty difficult. When everybody wants to help and everybody wants mm-hmm. to be a part of something exciting and different, mm-hmm. but when push comes to shove, I think you need to have two or three, you know, sort of underlying philosophies. Our first underlying philosophy was we had a no-fault policy. This wasn't anybody's fault, mm-hmm. and no one needs to be held to blame here. what we need to do is a better job.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we were failing with a lot of our things we were trying to do with kids.
Mm-hmm.
So we tried to institute a no-fault policy. I think that worked a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
We also said that we can all be parents of this project.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
we don't need anybody to say, this is mine, and I'm going to be the inventor here, and I'm going to be the one that's going to own it. We need everybody to own it.
Mm-hmm.
Convincing everybody to own it, and then own it in a way that makes them accountable for it, is a real challenge in collaboration. And then I think the third thing is, back to the resources. So what can you bring to the table that you're probably already doing, but maybe you need to just turn the dial a little bit to the left or right in terms of how you're doing it. For example, if you're, I'll give you a very good example. One of the agencies we found had a good number, probably the most young people using their neighborhood centers, their after-school programming at the agency level. So we wanted to try to find out what they were doing right. Why the kids from Shea were going to these agencies. And they would not share with us the names of the children. They said, we'll tell you that 12 kids are going to our, you know, after-school teen program, but we won't give you their names. So he said, well, look, this is a good resource. I mean, you got some good numbers. When you add up the kids that are going from this school to the different programs you're doing, pretty good job here. We want to see if we can replicate some of this, or maybe even get you more financial resources for this. But they said, well, no, you know, we can't do that. It's a confidential issue, you know. We said, there's nothing confidential about it. All we want to do is see why, you know, Frank and Frank are going to, you know, after school program X, Y, or Z. And they wouldn't do that. So in terms of bringing that resource to the table, that would have been a very good resource. And of course they wanted to help, and of course they wanted to cooperate up to a point.
Right.
And then they wouldn't change. And I think with a very modest change, like having the families sign off on just saying there's a special program happening at Shea, would you be willing to share some of the family information with the coordinators of all this? I don't think any family would have objected to that because in the end of the day, it probably would have provided better services for them. But they wouldn't do that. And so that sort of, you know, policy change, modest, we thought, policy change, wasn't going to happen with some of the organizations. Yet, they're very willing to be at the table, cooperate, et cetera. Well, cooperation is one thing, but, you know, when you collaborate, you say, here are the resources that we can bring. And this appeared to be a fairly substantial resource that we could have used. One of the other challenges that we found is we didn't know enough about the people and the neighborhood. And interesting because a lot of us, my children actually attended Shea when they were younger. And you know, I have strong roots in the neighborhood. But one of the things we said is, geez, we've got these after-school programs that we've started and we're promoting, but we can't get a lot of the kids to stay in participate. So we asked the kids, you know, why aren't you participating? What do we need to do to change this so that you... They said they couldn't. And they couldn't because they were going home and getting younger brother or younger sister off the bus and being the babysitter or child care provider till whatever parent situation happened, you know, dinner time or beyond. So the other reason is because we started to say, well, maybe you're not participating because of busing. And so we're going to put up this elaborate busing plan to have buses come back at 5 and take you, you know, as they would if they were 2:30. We said, don't bother because we need to be home. We need to be watching our younger brothers and sisters. We didn't realize that as we said, because everybody talks about after school programming. So I said, well, geez, we've got to do better. And that's why, that was one of the reasons I think why they expanded it to 6 schools, because now they include the elementary in there. So a little bit better coordination of, and why we need the database, because there needs to be this understanding of, okay, so what does family look like? And how, we can't just take the one young person who's in 6th or 7th grade. We've got to look at the whole family and what they're about. So that was another challenge. The other thing challenging that we found, Frank, was that we had gotten a grant from the state, I'm not going to remember the name of the state agency. In any event, we had a grant for 2 workers to go out into the homes and do social work with the families. And the biggest problem that they found was not that the families weren't going to cooperate or that they didn't care or some of those mythical things that we hear about. The biggest problem was the housing conditions that the people were living in. They came back to, and weekly would report on the poverty, the terrible housing conditions, and all the other issues affecting the family, not so much related to school or to the young person, but just that their day-to-day existence and trying to make it. And so that was another reason why this program, I think, has evolved into something that really does need the social services to be front and center and some other helping organizations, you know, whether it's the city to deal with, you know, absentee landlords or tenant issues, those kinds of things. So this is really, I think, evolving into a full service type of community school. But that was a real challenge because we weren't prepared. Because we were dealing with, okay, how can we help this young person be successful and stay in school, stay out of jail, you know, all those things. And then all of a sudden we get, wow, the housing conditions are terrible. What are we going to do about that? And so that was a bit of a surprise challenge for us. So
how do you know how well the program is working? What types of things do you look at?
Well, I you know, it's interesting, the outcomes that you know, what are the results, what are the measures? I think right now I can answer it two ways. First, for United Way, we're really honing in, and we've cast our lot with this database. We want to see this all be developed so that we can answer those question that you just asked better in a year or two. Because right now, everything is probably being tracked manually. That's our guess, okay? And so we're helping and we're trying to put funds and we're trying to guide them as best we can to develop a database where those kinds of questions, okay, what are the outcomes? So what are these outcomes? How are we going to know? Well, first of all, if we've got now the elementary K now through 8 that we're tracking, how many of those kids are making it to high school is a good, I think, a good outcome question. Okay, so you know, have they successfully gone through middle school and made it through high school? So, and then if the kid has dropped out in 6th, 7th, or 8th grade, or if they've lost track of the kid, have they been able to capture the kid back in and get him back, he or she back involved with the school?
So dropping out in middle school, there's a high dropout rate?
I think, you know, I don't want to give you a number because I can't remember what the number is, but I think we found that the number is not so much a dropout number, but because the families, and bear with me here, the families move around a lot. There is a percentage that they're using, and I think it was just in the paper again last week. I was surprised at how high it still is, of the families that move during the school year. And in moving that's how allegedly they lose a lot of the kids in the earlier grades. So I think you got to be, what, 16 in order to drop out?
Right.
That said, there still is no good program for when somebody's going to drop out that I know of. Now, maybe, again, City of Syracuse, they may have developed something. But I know when I was with the Private Industry Council, we were trying to develop a net to catch the kids. And we were going to develop an agreement with the city schools. Private Industry Council had a lot of federal funding through the Workforce Development Act. And one of the funding streams was that they gave us a considerable amount of money to deal with dropouts. And our problem was finding the dropouts. So what we tried to do was work with the city school district, and Steve Jones was the superintendent at the time, and work with them to say, look, when that student drops out, if you can notify us, we'll know. I mean, instead of looking at like saying, come on in, we've got this service for you, we'll know to call you and say, we understand you're no longer in school, we'd like to provide you with some alternatives. Those alternatives could be GED, could be some job training, or other typical workforce development programs, OCs. But our problem, they knew who the kids were, and they knew when they were dropping out. We didn't know who the kids were, but we had... And again, that's that sort of collaboration. You know, the resource that we were bringing to the table was money. mm-hmm. and the need to serve those kinds of kids mm-hmm. for our funding streams. Mm-hmm. They needed some alternative. I thought we came pretty close to an agreement, and then it just, unfortunately, it never happened. And I can't remember if it was the school board or the superintendent or how that ever occurred, but we were pretty convinced that was mm-hmm. the right way to go. Actually, Steve Jones had a whole committee that was working in this. But in any event, I believe in the middle school, it's more the families moving around and the kids sort of get lost mm-hmm. in the shuffle. Mm-hmm. When they do try to drop out, though, to my mind, I don't think it exists where there's a notification to any sort of an agency, mm-hmm. whether it's to a private industry council type agency or whether mm-hmm. it's to and this is where this database would work. Huntington Family Center might have the kid mm-hmm. in the Near West Side Service Strategy, the West Side Service Strategy. They would know, and they'd mm-hmm. be able to try to get that young person and get their family to have that young person get back in school. Mm-hmm. Having a database, because they'll be able to see, mm-hmm. Child hasn't been in school. But I don't know what the percentage is. I used to, but I don't
remember. Well, you've been involved. Could you give me just an overview of what the other things you've been involved in? You mentioned a bunch of interesting things. You mentioned the Destiny type of
thing. Yeah. At 2020, one of the things, and this was really driven, both these initiatives, by the way, not only the Community School Initiative, but the Destiny one, was driven by a woman who has since passed away. Her name was Joanne Reddick. Joanne Reddick was an African-American lady who was a principal at Nottingham High School for a long period of time, but really was a very engaged and involved community activist after she retired from Nottingham, or from being a principal. And Joanne was on Syracuse 2020, and her main concern was young people, particularly African-American young people, and she really gave me an amazing education. But one of the frustrations Joanne had was she would watch these schools in the city get renovated and mm-hmm. rehabbed with lots of public money and lots of construction jobs and lots of opportunity. Mm-hmm. And then she would say, she would watch the guys on the corner across the street hang out, watch the thing get mm-hmm. done, mm-hmm. but never have an opportunity to mm-hmm. to get involved, mm-hmm. to get mm-hmm. some meaningful work.
Right.
And so one of her things became, look, if Destiny's going to get built, uh-huh. and going to get built with some public money, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. however we want to define that, mm-hmm. we should have our people, mm-hmm. the young men especially, in the neighborhoods, city neighborhoods, have an opportunity to work there. Mm-hmm. And so Joanne and I went about meeting with the Destiny folks. B. Gonzalez, who's the mm-hmm. president of the Common Council, mm-hmm. joined us. Mm-hmm. We created a coalition of probably 20-some organizations that were interested in doing some job readiness mm-hmm. programs, mm-hmm. where we knew we couldn't train people to be motor equipment operators mm-hmm. or that mm-hmm. sort of thing, mm-hmm. but we could get them ready to take on laborer jobs, mm-hmm. get them ready by having, I think, 30 to 60 days of instruction about showing up, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. about how to do resumes, how to do simple math, mm-hmm. Testing them to see where they were mm-hmm. in terms of some of the basic tests. I'm trying to remember some of the names that we would use. If GED was something mm-hmm. somebody wanted, we would have that available. Mm-hmm. And so what we did was go about working with the Destiny folks, who signed on for this, by the mm-hmm. way, were very mm-hmm. interested in mm-hmm. it, and still have sort of a hybrid of it now, mm-hmm. with mm-hmm. how they bring people in. But Destiny wanted to do not only construction, but they also wanted people ready for the hospitality mm-hmm. and hotel type of business, and they also wanted people ready for the retail. So Destiny took on a bit of a Disney approach to this, and frankly, I think it's the right approach, where it's real holistic. This is what we want our employees to be about. Mm-hmm. And again, they have a bit of a hybrid there. We were about trying to get people construction jobs, entry level laborer construction jobs, and so we appealed to the federal offices. We went to Senator Clinton's office, mm-hmm. Senator Schumer, Congressman Walsh, and the local state and assembly offices, plus the city and the county. Mm-hmm. And the city and the county, I think, we had a commitment for $500,000. Mm-hmm. We looked for the, I think we looked for a million from the state and a million from the federal. We never got it. We got a half a million towards this. Mm-hmm. And what happened was at the time, because it was early in the Destiny process, we got some folks ready through this jobs readiness, through City School District, through BOCES, and I think OCC was the third group, educational group. I believe the City School District trained approximately 40 or 50 for the job readiness, and then the Destiny Project fell apart for a series of years.
Mm-hmm.
And so the project at that point fell apart.
Mm-hmm.
But that's how kind of we got involved with Destiny. And I'm told that one of the photos that they were taking at the time, they're still up down in the Destiny, the new part, where they started with all these community meetings. And Destiny was very committed to this and wanted this to happen and wanted to have a very diverse, you know, workforce. Mm-hmm. And I think today probably does as an offshoot of this. But that's how that started to come about.
Was it in the mall itself?
If you go down, I know my photo's there.
Mm-hmm.
If you go down in the lower part of the mall, mm-hmm. there's a Destiny display.
Mm-hmm.
And you would see pictures of various community folks meeting with the Destiny officials. And I'm told that my photo's down there. Mm-hmm. I don't go to the mall that often.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm trying to think where that is, but I'll have to check it.
Yeah, it's in the base. If you went
the
in
middle
the
part, where you can go all the way to the basement.
When you go all the way to the basement, and then I guess there's three or four different ways you can kind of go off of that middle. One of them has a display area. I'm told.
Oh, neat. Great. Well, I'm wondering, and you know, you've been involved in a bunch of different things. Now you're in a place where you see many different proposals. What do you? And I know there are committees that decide on who
sure.
gets funded,
yep.
but you would be in a place where you'd see what types of things are being funded, what types of things draw funds, what types of things people get excited about.
Yeah.
Could you give me a feel for those?
Sure, yeah. It's sort of a double-edged sword for me, Frank. We have five vision areas,
mm-hmm.
and those five vision areas are dealing right now with almost $10 million in program proposals.
Mm-hmm.
We don't have quite five to pass out. We're thinking we've got about $4.9 million that we're going to be able to pass out. So our funding is then, once it's there, assuming the campaigns run successfully, then it's there for 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
And so in the vision areas, one is dealing with very young people where they typically, those kinds of proposals would be for daycare centers and I'll give you an idea here. The vision area is nurturing, protecting, and teaching young children. So Child Care Solutions gives out daycare scholarships. Well, there's counseling programs, there's respite programs. I mean, it's just a variety, a little over $1 million there. Then the second vision area is helping young people grow into thriving adults. And, you know, a lot of the teen types of programs. Actually, one of the things that I was very pleased that we did is we did a program last time around. I believe they're applying again for gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender questioning youth. And last year, they had an opening of what they call the Q Center, questioning center.
Oh.
And I went to it. And, you know, some of the kids were dressed up pretty interesting. I mean, I think part of that is that they just, you know, dress differently and look differently. But as I started talking to one young lady in particular, she was starting to tell me a little bit about herself, that she was a senior in high school, and that, you know, she was looking for college. And I said, oh, you know, what college are you going to go to? She goes, I can go to anyone in the country. And I said, what do you mean? And she then told me she had a Toyota or a Honda scholarship, like worth $20,000 that she could you know, use for any college that she wanted to. So this kid was obviously pretty smart, pretty competitive, pretty typical, you know, teenager, except she was questioning some things about herself. And so really learned a lot that day just about myself and about how I would, you know, interact with the kids and everything. But also, some of our donors, when there was an article about this, commented to me. I figured, oh, you know, this is either going to be real good or real bad. And they commented to me how they were really proud that, that they could have given money to United Way to support something like this because they bullied these kind of kids when they were younger. And now they're feeling a little bit better that at least they're given a few dollars to make their life a little bit better than they did when they were a kid. So those kinds of programs are some of the more different ones that we have. On Point for College, I'm very proud is in that, you know, category as well. A third category that we have is providing safety net services. And these are your typical, you know, Red Cross programs for disaster services or the Food Bank of Central New York doing their perishable foods pickup, Samaritan Center, hot meals every day, at least one hot meal a day, 5-7 days a week. A fourth area is enabling people to live self-sufficiency and independence. And, well, the Jewish Community Center has a senior adult service. And when we United Way did our own internal campaign last year with our staff, we said, let's look at some things that weren't maybe not quite that familiar with. So we went up and had lunch with the seniors one day up at the Jewish Community Center. Fascinating experience from us because we got to talk to them a little bit about why they go there and what it's all about. And not necessarily that they're, you know, need food or that they can't afford their own food. It's the camaraderie. It's the information that they get. It's the fact that they feel better about themselves and take better care about them of themselves if they go out rather than be at home and make themselves a, you know, not that there's anything wrong with chicken noodle soup from, you know, Campbell's, but this is a nutritious, you know, lunch at least once a day, the meal once a day that they're having.
So the people of all ages?
Actually, no. These are senior citizens that go there. Only senior citizens. That's right. Then there's various other types of... one of the programs I'm really proud of and try to go there a lot is the Provisions Restaurant down in Armory Square. I don't know if you're familiar with that or not. But Transitional Living Services runs that as part of their program. These are people with mental health problems or other mental issues that they've had in their life. They're re-entering the workforce, and they're re-entering it through the Provisions Restaurant and Bakery.
Where is that?
It is on Walton Street. Are you familiar with Armory Square at all?
Somewhat, yeah.
Let me try to give you a landmark. On the corner where there's Starbucks, and then there's a coffee shop across the street, it's the next block up going west, and it's on the right-hand side as you go west of Walton Street. Jack Daniels Bar.
Oh, yes.
Daniels Piano Bar or something.
Yes.
It's two doors down
from
that.
So it's right
around
there. Okay.
It's two doors down from that. Yeah. There's a You Frame It shop on the corner. It's about four doors down from that on that same side.
Okay.
And it's just a great... you talk about entrepreneurship, and this is in the truest sense. I mean, you know, they make money off of this. But we give them just a modest grant, so $21,000 a year, to help supplement, you know, their costs for, you know, the operation of the bakery and the restaurant. And then finally, our fifth area is supporting people facing difficult personal and family problems, and this really deals with some of the more serious, you know, mental health issues through the Mental Health Association, the domestic violence issues, like with Your House, those kinds of very, very serious types of things, psychotherapy, Catholic charities. So those are our vision areas, and this is where we're determining where to spend the money now. For me, personally, there's never enough money, and I try to remain neutral. I do have some opinions on what I think are successful programs, what I think are programs we shouldn't be funding, but with the way our process is set up, we have about now 12 to 15 volunteers in each of the vision areas mm-hmm. working on this now. Some of them have had considerable experience with this over the years. Others are just well-meaning community folks who've been mm-hmm. trained to each of them have to go through a training with mm-hmm. us in order to review the programs and come up with their recommendations. Mm-hmm. Then it goes to our community impact cabinet. Mm-hmm. And then from there to our executive committee and then to our board of directors. Mm-hmm. Rarely will I intervene and say, mm-hmm. this is not a good program, we shouldn't be funding this. Mm-hmm. Often I bite my tongue. Mm-hmm. And sometimes I have to give a perspective about, maybe more what we might be missing if we don't fund somebody mm-hmm. than if we do. Mm-hmm. Because I think there are certain neighborhoods in the city and certain consumers in the city that we can't overlook. And so, for example, we fund a very modest program with Exceptional Family Resources, I believe it is. Bear with me here just for a second. It's a respite program for families who have children with autism. Mm. And to me, this is something that we never would have enough money and can't do enough for this kind of population. Yeah, it's a take a break. I'm sorry. It's a Exceptional Family Resources. It's a take a break respite program. Give a modest amount of money to that, $25,000. But it's the type of program where people who have autistic children mm-hmm. Do need at times to just kind of step back mm-hmm. and have a little time to themselves and kind of mm-hmm. Reconnoiter as to what their lives, where they're going, mm-hmm. how they're doing mm-hmm. it. And so I think those kinds of programs, again, we would never have enough money. We could give all $5 million mm-hmm. to that kind of thing, but I think there are some statements that mm-hmm. we need to make about those kinds of special populations, and that would be one that I would say, do we really not want to fund this? Mm-hmm. So that's kind of where my intervention would come in.
All right, great. Well, I have two more questions.
Sure.
One is how you got into this line of work. How did you major in innovative? And what was your major?
Undergraduate major at Stonehill College was sociology.
Oh, really?
And Stonehill is very similar. Matter of fact, one of the reasons why I went there was so similar to Lemoyne, but it was in Massachusetts, mm-hmm. run by the Holy Cross Fathers. And I would remind my friend Father Charles Byrne, when the U.S. News and World Report would come out, that Stonehill always seemed to be one or two spaces ahead of Lemoyne. It's very same category. That's how you rank. So I was a sociology major there, and then I got my master's degree at Syracuse University at Maxwell School.
In what?
Public administration. How I got into this particular kind of innovative work, I would say at least two, maybe three motivators, not in any order. I think when I was with Catholic Charities in the early 70s, not right after I got out of college, I did some teaching for a few years. But when I went to Catholic Charities, I sort of became the person running the division. It was the parish division. And it was a division that we could be innovative. We could mm-hmm. do sort of the creative R&D work, mm-hmm. Especially with the Catholic parishes, mm-hmm. because there were people that were very creative out there, very willing to help, mm-hmm. hungry for let's do some things different that are going to mm-hmm. work. Mm-hmm. So we could try a lot of different things. Mm-hmm. So I started there, and then when I went to the city of Syracuse, I think the next big step there for me was I worked for a man who would not accept, we tried this 10 years ago, Tom Young. Mm-hmm. And he was always looking to say, how can we do it better? How can we be more efficient and effective? Not in a trite sort of way, but it was always so prove it. Mm-hmm. And so he challenged us to be innovative and creative. And to be honest with you, that was a very rewarding. At that point, it was rewarding to be able to say, let's take on this behemoth project that may or may not work, but the fact that we can try to do it and try to do it different and better, make someone's life a little bit better, that was really the jazz of working that way. And then, of course, it just kind of mushroomed from there with, you know, 2020 and now with United Way. I mean, we see some incredible things happen here at United Way that we don't even pay for, that it's all done by volunteers. And it's all done because they want to do something to make their community a better place to live. That's pretty neat stuff to be able to work with. I don't know if that's a straight answer to your question.
No, that was great.
A little bit roundabout way.
Actually, I guess I do have two questions then. What would you tell a young person in college right now as far as how to get into this type of work now, in the present day? I mean, you know, you entered in a different time.
In college?
Someone who's in college, right? Someone who's taking this class.
Somebody's taking this class, how to get into it?
Yeah,
that's easy. I would say that they ought to challenge you or the administration or someone to allow them an internship or a volunteer experience that they can begin to get a taste of whether they really like this work or not. Because there's a certain edge to it that you need to understand and like. And if you don't, it's a good way to screen it out, filter it out now before you get out of school.
What do you mean, edge?
You know, the edge, and I'm not saying it's a jagged edge, it can be a smooth edge, is that you have to be able to understand that people can't always be like you. They come with lots of issues in their lives and multiple challenges that aren't easily solved. And if you want to go in and figure, oh, I'm going to just wave my hand and cure all this, there's no easy answers to that. There's no easy answers to their multiple problems. And you have to get in there and be willing to work, you know, really daily to try to solve some of these things. And even then, if you miss a week, you might miss the family forever. Because they'll... So, I guess what I'm saying is you need to have... I don't know whether it's a persistence. Maybe just a real 30,000-foot view of what this work is all about. And you need to know that there are days where, you know, it's going to be great. You're going to see things that really make you feel like you're really doing something worthwhile. There are other days where it isn't going to be so. And I guess contrasting that, in the private sector, you know, you're going to have this, I mean, one day you make a profit, the next day you don't. The third day you might make a profit or it may not. Some similarities, but much more clearer results, much more clearer outcomes. We talked about outcomes earlier, and we could spend hours just talking on, you know, well, how do you really define and there is no one outcome that can say, okay, this family is now successful. But you can say, we created this product and we've sold this product and we've made money on it. That's success. If you want that kind of a career, then you better know that that's the... If you want very identifiable, easy outcomes and results, don't get into this sort of work. I don't know, maybe that's a clearer answer.
Sounds helpful. And how would you define social entrepreneurship in your own words?
I would define it as identifying a problem or a challenge, or whatever word you want to use there, and then developing strategies to confront that challenge, and then as you develop the challenge, as you develop the strategies, defining what your outcomes want to be. And knowing that those outcomes may be not achievable in the short term, they may be long term outcomes, but that you need to do, you need to have your mind clear and free to look at things in a different way and to be able to try and do different or non-traditional methods to get to those outcomes. That's probably too much of a mouthful for social entrepreneurism, but
It's fine.
I guess I'll stay with that.
Yeah, sounds good. That's why I bring the tape recorder.
Don't be afraid to use some poetic license and clean up some of
these. Well, yeah, I mean, you'll have final edit on, that. See, and at this point, you know, I'm not even sure which each case study. There are only two pages, and the idea is to be able to use them in class and have the students be able to read them right then and then react to them. And I don't, you know, really, it's sitting down with all these and trying to figure out how we can line these up to make sense for a course. But, you know, actually something jumped out when one of your areas was self-sufficiency.
Yes.
How are these areas set? Because I'm noticing that all over the place. Is that in any way tied to federal monies?
No.
Okay, because that's a buzzword.
It is, yeah. It's funny, though. Self-sufficiency is becoming, I won't say it's a buzzword, but more and more, we're seeing a phenomenon. Our research showed this. I can send you the piece that was done by Knowledge Systems and Research, KSNR. We enlisted to do some research earlier in 07, Frank. And one of the things that pointed to was that in this community right now, Onondaga County, we have a lot of people, and I'm trying very carefully not to call them the working poor, okay? But that population of people who are working but needing additional public services, it continues to rise. And so, you know, with that, what we're trying to do is sort of confront that by saying, you know, we need to provide, make sure that their agencies are providing services so that people can maintain their self-sufficiency. And it's becoming a real, real challenge in this community right now. The other thing about self-sufficiency that you're probably hearing is all in regard to this earned income tax credit and some of these other programs that are hopefully getting people. United Way, actually, America is pushing sort of a financial stability approach to things. We're getting people away from entitlement programs and getting them more to be on their own and able. Actually, United Way, I think, has taken a real leap where they're saying, you know, let's eventually get people in, poor people, to be thinking about investments and, you know, managing money. I think that's way, way down the road. We're just trying to get them to come in and get their taxes done for free and not go to, you know, Jackson Hewitt and places like that. So that's, it won't surprise me that you'll hear more and more about that over the next few years.
Yeah. HUD grants, the 1996 welfare reform. Oh, there's just a lot of people that I've been talking to that's a recurring word.
Well, yeah, and with welfare reform, the TANF issues are just huge right now because you've got people, you know, they got to work 30 hours a week. It's a mindless thing that they're not really getting trained to do anything to better their lives, to become more self-sufficient. And believe me, we don't have time today, but if you want, when I was at the Private Industry Council, that was probably one of our biggest challenges, is to try to confront the welfare to work people who would share clients. We wanted to put our clients in training so that they could, you know, have a clearer career path. And their whole thing with clients is we must make them work in order for them to get their, you know, welfare grant.
So there was a real
conflict.
Conflict between
absolute
caseworkers there.
And often at the end of the day, I would have to try to come in and convince, as the executive director, convince, you know, the people on the other side, free up this person to get training, so that, you know, they're not working a job forever at $8 an hour. They're never going to be self-sufficient doing that. But under their rules, that's what they had to be doing, and they could then provide them with food stamps or, you know, daycare subsidies or whatever else, as long as they kind of stayed. I call it warehousing people. And that's a warehouse for a person where, you know, they're, and I remember that, God, we, Frank, I can tell you, I won't tell you, I'd stay on the record with this, because I will remember the lady's name. She was a person who was doing ironing. And she, you know how you take your clothes to the dry cleaner, and they have these huge irons that they use, and this is what she was doing. It was like $8 an hour. She wanted to be in nurse training. She was going to start with LPN, and eventually, now remember, nursing, even at that time, in the early 2000s and late 90s, was a field that had a shortage of workers. If you're an RN now, you can make a ton of dough, and talk about being self-sufficient. You can almost name your hours because there's such a shortage of RNs. Mm-hmm. They wouldn't let her get started as an LPN in order to kind of work her way up because she had to be in this mindless, and we were going to pay for the training. The training dollars, the education dollars weren't the issue. The issue was they wouldn't let her out of her service, the TANF or welfare to work service. And it was just a terrible, I remember it was just an awfully tense time because this woman had all the, she tested well. I mean, she just had every possibility that she was going to be successful, but they wouldn't let her go. And I remember she became a real cause for us.
So the private industry counselor was private industries, or was, I mean,
no,
or
that
was
the
city?
The private industry counselor was a corporation, not-for-profit corporation, run by the city and the county. Today it's known as CNY Works.
All right.
And they received the $5 to $6 million federal money that came through the Workforce Development Act. It was federal money that was passed through to the State Department of Labor and then given down to the the private industry council.
Okay. So what became of her? She just
don't know,
and never were able to come to an agreement.
Could
to
not agree that, that this lady should go on the train. But that's when you talk self-sufficiency.
Yeah,
that lady's,
yeah.
Want to say Norma or whatever her name is. That lady always comes to mind because that was our point. Is that it? You know, with job training funds, you have an intense amount of money for a short period of time. You need to invest it wisely so that someone can come out of that with an opportunity to find a job. If it done the right way, it can work. But there's so many rules that you know that the welfare folks put onto this. That you know, we had young people. We could take young people up to 21 in our summer jobs program. So we had young moms who were on welfare, and they were getting rounded off $1,000, maybe $1,200 a week from summer work. They would call them in and reduce their welfare grants that amount or whatever formula they had to follow. So these were modest summer jobs that might lead to at least something they could put on a resume or a job application, likely not a full-time job, but in their minds they needed to reduce their welfare grant because that's what's costing this county and the state money. It just made no sense at all. So we were particularly frustrated with that. So so in terms of allowing people the opportunity, enabling them to have the opportunity to be self-sufficient, we are our own worst enemy in many cases. Real difficult.
That's interesting, because I mean, that people tend to say, oh, that was a big success. Both political parties point to the welfare reform as a, well, because caseload's dropped.
And that's it. Caseload's dropped, but where did the people go? And what are they doing now? And a lot will, I mean, I guess if you ever wanted to do sort of a where did they go, is you have people in the there's like 70 or 80 food pantries in this county. And I could give you the exact number if you're ever interested in having students do a project like this. But all those people that are going to the food pantries on a regular basis, find out how many of them were in or are still in some sort of a TANF situation, and were in this welfare to work, you know, quagmire, because they may very well be working at this kind of a job that I mentioned to you about this lady, but they can't make it through the month without getting some sort of food assistance. And I talked to, I was recently as last week, the lady at the Samaritan Center. I mean, some of the stuff that we have to deal with, to me, is just, how can this be in 2008? But she, last week, I heard from our Success by Six people that they might bring books to the Samaritan Center and have a bookcase or two. And that was kind of one of their signatures, is so that means there's young people that are going to read these books, or that moms or dads are going to read the books to the kids. And so I talked to the lady about some other things, and I asked about this, and she goes, what's happening at her Samaritan Center is that she described it as not an emergency. What we think of the Samaritan Center is, I'll use myself, because I don't know about your situation, but I get down on my luck, just my wife and I, and we can't make it through the month. So last week of February, starting tonight, we have to go to the food to the Samaritan Center and get our dinner.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? But we're down on our luck this month. In 2 months, once we get our bills in order and once I get the credit counseling I need and everything like that, I'm gonna be okay.
Mm-hmm.
All right? Not so. What she's suggesting is this is a chronic problem now.
Mm-hmm.
So this last week, before my money is renewed in March 1st, or before I can make ends meet because my food stamps have run out and my other monies, even though I'm working, okay, I'm going to need this assistance. So what she said to me is it's not an emergency, sort of safety net, as much as it's becoming a service because it's a chronic problem. And that's a huge issue in this community. And that become, and again, I haven't done anything in terms of a survey or a scientific, but as I talk to people, tell me, why are we having more need for food than ever before and more requests?
You are having that.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
So people, there's more requests to the United Way.
There's more requests for these food programs. There's more need for this kind of an operation. The numbers are increasing.
Mm-hmm.
And it appears that it's because people who are working $7, $8, $9 an hour jobs, whatever that wage is, their expenses are just, more than their income is for the month.
Mm-hmm.
And they need these kinds of services in order to get through. So it's becoming more of a chronic service that people have to rely on. Okay, I'm in a jam for 2 months, but I'm going to be okay in May. It's not that anymore, apparently. Now, so when you talk self-sufficiency, there's another there's another element to this.
So you think that's likely related to the welfare to work type of...
I do, and I think it's related to the wages that some people are getting. Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. And I think we forget, just take a look at your own situation with your filling up your car for gas, and how many times you have to do that a month. And so if you're a family that's on a very, very strict budget, how you're going to be able to do that and still provide the necessary staples, food, clothing, and shelter. So if you got to pay your rent, you got to get to work, so you got to drive. We don't have good public transportation here for that. Clothing is what it is. So, there are certain things that at the end of the month gets tight. Food is something that you've got to go and get some assistance with. And that's happening more and more. And that's why I say, because if we had all these jobs that people are saying we have, then why is this? And it's because the wages of the jobs are not high enough to allow people to live with more self-sufficiency. So I think that's why you're hearing this buzz term, because I'm not sure we've got any good answers for it right now either.
All right. That's an interesting way to put it. You mentioned there was a KSR study. Was that Vincent Kama's group? Rita Riker?
Yep. We engage them before we start our allocations process, our 3-year allocations process, we always get them to do a scan, a community scan for us. And this year, it's already a year old almost. They did it in 07. And I can email that to you if you're interested in seeing it. It's about 70 pages. It's a lengthy study.
70?
Yeah, it's probably about 70. But it's a good piece if you want to look at it. And I think one of the things in there we found is that we better make sure that there are program submissions, and that's what I think we're seeing. The phenomena that we're seeing this time around is the program submissions to help people get to this point of self-sufficiency, and to avoid the food pantries. I think are the newest types of programs that we're seeing.
And that scan sort of helps you know what types of things you want to encourage in that.
Exactly.
Oh, that's interesting. Because I sort of wondered, how do funding agencies know? Is that sort of a common practice to have?
For us, it's been pretty traditional. Uh-huh. Yeah. I think we probably do it more formally. Although we always say we just, wasn't an inexpensive study. We paid about $30,000 for it. But Vince and Rita are great. They gave us a huge deal on it.
So it was Vincent and Rita who do...
Rita was the one we worked through with it. But I think I know they had staff that decided. Mm-hmm. Rita didn't do it herself.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm pretty familiar with them. Actually, when I was with 2020, I was stationed at their offices. Mm-hmm. Their president at the time, who has since passed away, Ann Michael, was one of the co-chairs of Syracuse 2020. She was one of the founders of it. And for her... Talk about resources on the table. She gave us free office space, pro bono office space, pro bono secretarial services, and we didn't pay a dime for anything, printing services, anything like that. So those were the resources she brought to the table in order to support Syracuse 2020. So I'm very familiar with that cast and iron, and because of that, you know, although I can't steer the selection there, I was really encouraged when they came forward with a proposal, and so, yeah, we had them do this in 07. So I can email you.
You should put bids out for different groups.
Yes. And then, yep.
Because actually, I was thinking of contacting them to talk about, related to careers in sociology. Do you know who would be a good person to talk to there?
Oh, I would go right to Vince.
Go to Vince.
Sure, Vince was doing, because I subbed for him one time. Mm-hmm. Vince was doing the... He was teaching, I'm laughing because it was the easiest sub job I ever took. He was teaching medical students sociology.
Oh, okay.
At Upstate.
Mm-hmm.
And they didn't know anything. I mean, it was just incredible. And I laughed. He laughed. He says, when you get there, he goes, just talk about some of the things that you're involved with now. They're going to love it. He goes, they don't know anything. And, of course, they're medical students, but they were required at the time. This was several years ago. But Vince is very tuned into things. And if you wanted to, you know, be interesting. Now, there's a sort of a filter. I don't think they do interns over there, I doubt. But boy, if you wanted to, you know, find out that end of it, you know, really, because they're very sophisticated, as you can imagine, in terms of some of their clients, and in terms of understanding data and understanding what all of these things mean. But they have you probably know this, Frank. They have a heavy aging group over there in terms of their study of aging, their study of particularly of senior health facilities. I know they used to do a lot of work with Loretto and with other senior community living services, health centers, that sort of thing. So they're pretty heavy into the aging population and studying that and understanding that. So again, in terms of social work career, that to me is one of the fields that we need to do more of.
Do you mean applied research and so forth?
Not only research, but preparing people to deal with folks that are
aging.
Oh,
yeah. Baby boom.
It's huge. Huge. So I think that Vince could be an interesting
guy. Yeah, maybe I'll talk to him. He's a sociologist, I think, right, by training?
I think by training he might have been. Another guy you might want to talk to is Brian Walton from Catholic Charities, executive director of Catholic Charities. Brian's been there 30-some years. Started off as a probation officer with the county. And he could give an interesting perspective to your students. Linda Wright, executive director of Salvation Army. And if I were you, if you're thinking of bringing in some other speakers, Dwayne Kinnon, who's with the Syracuse Boys and Girls Club, and who's done some social work down in New York City, I believe, with Salvation Army there. You know, so you get kind of a perspective from Vince in the private sector, and Brian, who's been with a kind of a traditional institution like Catholic Charities, white male, Linda, white female with Salvation Army, Dwayne, black male, with Boys and Girls Club. And I don't know how much, I don't know how good she is as a speaker or give you a perspective, but there is a lady running this West Side Service strategy now. Her name is Monique Fletcher. She's an African-American female. And Monique, it'd be interesting, I don't even know if she knows a lot of the history that I went over with you, but she's now got probably between 6 and 12 people that she's supervising, I would think, in this project.
Exciting. Oh my gosh, now I've got my work cut out for me.
Yeah, you got a little more homework.
Yeah.
We haven't talked about civilian review board or anything like that, but I don't know what, you know, like I say, you know, some of the stuff, I think your students can go and research it if they wanted to, like with Civilian Review. They could look at it now, and I could tell them how it got to be from when I was with the city. Actually, I did a couple of lectures on this at Maxwell, and with a little bit of notice, could put the actual information together about the coalitions that worked on this.
What is Civilian Review again?
Civilian Review Board is an entity of the city government that was created by the Syracuse Common Council. In many cities around the country have them, and what they do is they review the activities of the police department, in this case the Syracuse Police Department. And the intent, I believe the intent was to review their activities. What we saw I was with the city administration when this started, when it came to be, it was an issue that had been talked about for years. But we saw in other cities where it wasn't necessarily just review what the police had done, but try to establish community policing efforts in neighborhoods with people, so that people would begin to trust the police more and be able to, have confidence in them and rely on them. But it also was to try to do some training of both from the citizens' point of view and what the police actions are all about and what the citizens can do to help police understand how to deal with some of the issues in the neighborhood. And I'll give you it's almost a trite example, but it's absolutely true. A lot of the officers looked like you or I, and they were from the suburbs. And when you or I walked by, or when these young officers, and they were in their 20s or 30s, early 30s, and when they walked by a group of young African-American males or females, they didn't quite know how to take some of the stuff that they were saying or talking about. Well, the training, and actually the Syracuse Police Department does a little bit of this with the Latino, where they have Latino, particularly high school youth and college youth, teaching officers Spanish. Well, it's the same sort of concept, but it's not so much about Spanish as it is about, sir, here's what we're thinking and saying about you and the neighborhood. You need to understand that a little bit. Here's when we're joking, and here's when we're serious, so that something doesn't escalate because an officer doesn't really know the mores, the traditions of that neighborhood. Doing the dozens, whatever you want to call it, and takes it the wrong way, and then something occurs. So that kind of training is supposed to be part of this too. Well, I think the evolution of where it is now, my guess is that your students would be really hard pressed to find out what are the outcomes here? What's this all about? Because I think they've been trying to almost be punitive, and they can't. The contracts of the police department won't allow it. And the police themselves, the blue line, won't allow it. So there's real history here. But that's something that maybe if your students get involved with. That's the thing that they can learn, though, by the way. We talk about screening things out in terms of career. That's the sort of thing that they really want to look at in terms of, how to work in neighborhoods, how to maybe be involved with the police or as a social worker. What do you do when you're involved with the police? In a meaningful way, not in a way that's, combative or negative. So we didn't cover that.
Excellent. All right. Well, I've taken up an hour and 17 minutes.